Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents When Giants Ruled the Sky, The Brief Reign and Tragic Demise of the American Rigid Airship, by John J. Gagan, narrated by Tom Perkins. In this plodding commercial age, this day of humdrum money-grubbing and of the routine, though admirable, round of quiet duty-doing, it is a good thing, I think, for the few of us who can, to leave the beaten track, fare forth into strange fields, and strive mightily to do things which are exceedingly difficult and dangerous, and the more fascinating because they are difficult and dangerous. Walter Wellman, Airship Pilot, The Aerial Age, 1911. Preface. It is easy to dismiss the rigid airship as predestined to failure, but this explains nothing. Richard K. Smith, Airship Historian. Why listen to a book about airships? The answer is simple, because most of what we know about them is wrong. In retrospect, airships might seem like fragile dodo birds destined for extinction, but for the first 30 years of the 20th century, they were viewed as a more robust means of transportation than the aeroplane, consistently surpassing them in range, flight duration, and load-carrying capacity. By comparison, early aeroplanes were noisy, all-splattering affairs that could only carry a handful of passengers, flew mostly in daylight, were often grounded by poor weather, and crashed with alarming frequency. And yet the history of aviation remains focused on heavier-than-air, HTA, flight. It's not difficult to understand why, but it's a bias that overshadows some truly amazing airship accomplishments. Consider the following. In 1901, Alberto Santos Dumont, a Brazilian multimillionaire with soulful eyes and a penchant for depression, needed only 30 minutes to complete an 8-mile circular course around the Eiffel Tower in his No. 6 dirigible. What's more, the diminutive Brazilian did it 2 years before the Wright brothers flew at Kitty Hawk, an impressive display of powered navigable flight. To give the Wright brothers their due, their engineering acumen made them first to crack the code of HTA flight. Nevertheless, they were far from being the first men to fly, which may come as a surprise to many. Additionally, they weren't quite the heroes they're painted to be, as we'll soon see. In 1910, German airships began carrying paying passengers on a regularly scheduled route 4 years before the first scheduled commercial airline service began in the United States. In 1919, a British airship, the R-34, was the first aircraft of any type to make a round-trip voyage across the Atlantic, something no aeroplane of the day could accomplish. Although Alcock and Brown succeeded in being the first to fly across the Atlantic a few weeks before the R-34, they took a considerably shorter route, flew only one way, and made a very hard landing in Ireland. By comparison, the R-34's flight was smooth sailing. If that's not impressive, the R-34 completed her record-making flight 8 years before Lindbergh crossed the Atlantic on his solo one-way flight to Paris, and did so carrying passengers. In 1926, an Italian airship, the Norge, flew over the North Pole, marking the first time any land, air, or sea expedition incontrovertibly reached that destination. Despite Frederick Cook and Robert Peary each claiming to have reached the North Pole first in 1908 and 1909, respectively, neither claim was ever verified, and both remain controversial. In the case of Richard Byrd's 1926 overflight of the North Pole, he later admitted his navigation was faulty. In 1929, another German airship, the Graf Zeppelin, LZ-127, circled the globe 6 times faster than the first aeroplane to do so. 2 years later, the Graf commenced a regularly scheduled passenger service between Germany and South America with occasional stops in New Jersey, a performance no other aircraft of the day could match. Lighter-than-air, LTA, flight may be a withered branch on aviation's tree, but its history is important because it's where human flight first began. When Giants Ruled the Sky will not only correct many of the popular misconceptions associated with airships, but explain why so many people expected they would surpass ocean liners and transcontinental trains as the preferred means of long-distance transportation, especially for the wealthy. One popular misconception is that the Hindenburg, LZ-129, crash brought an end to the airship era. Giants will show this isn't the case. Additionally, the Hindenburg's fiery demise killed far fewer people than many of us assume. Of the 97 passengers and crew aboard that fateful day, two-thirds, 62 people, survived the disaster. This casualty rate of 35% was far lower than the major aeroplane, train, and ocean liner disasters of the day. Given 1,503 souls were lost on the Titanic, the Hindenburg's death toll of 35 is small by comparison. In fact, Germany remained so confident in the future of airship travel that she began flying a replacement, the Graf Zeppelin II, LZ-130, only 4 months after the Hindenburg crash, and continued to operate her for another 2 years. The Germans even had a sister airship under construction, the LZ-131, when the Second World War intervened. What most people don't realize is that before the Hindenburg disaster, German airships transported tens of thousands of paying passengers millions of miles without a single passenger fatality, a safety record unmatched by any other form of transportation. Although it's true that the number of deaths attributable to airship crashes was astounding when compared to the small number of craft that were built, airships were promoted by their adherents as the safest form of long-distance transportation. One reason so many people expected airships to become the dominant form of long-distance transport was that the U.S. Navy, in partnership with the Goodyear Tire and Rubber Company and German airship manufacturer Luftschiffbau Zeppelin, were determined to sell the public on the speed, comfort, and safety of airship travel. Twice as fast as the speediest ocean liner, to which they were frequently compared, airships seemed ubiquitous during the 1920s and early 30s, appearing over Tokyo, Washington, D.C., Rio de Janeiro, the Egyptian pyramids, and New York's Empire State Building. The Empire State Building, the tallest skyscraper in the world when completed, was even built with an airship mooring station at its top. As a result, airships didn't just capture the public's imagination in the way the American space program would many years later. They held it firmly in their grasp for 3 decades until airplane technology matured enough to eventually overtake them. What may surprise the listener is just how close America came to having her own fleet of gigantic, globe-spanning airships. Designed to carry passengers, mail, and cargo, these behemoths were not only intended to fly from New York to California, but across the Pacific, the Atlantic, and down the length of South America. And yet, passenger ships ply the ocean today while commercial airlines flourish. Meanwhile, the big rigid airship is extinct. An explanation why is long overdue. One reason airships seemed destined to succeed was that between 1917 and 1935, the United States Navy poured tens of millions of dollars into an experimental program that built a series of increasingly sophisticated dirigibles, larger and more expensive than anything that had ever flown. The biggest of the lot, the USS Akron, ZRS-4, and her sister ship, the USS Macon, ZRS-5, were so large they equaled the RMS Lusitania in length. 14 stories tall and 2.5 football fields long, these self-contained cities in the sky could venture aloft with an 80-man crew for days at a time when an aeroplane's range was limited, ocean liners slow, and no railroad truly transcontinental. There was only one problem. The Navy's airships kept crashing. Even when the Navy was warned that its airships had a potentially fatal design flaw, it refused to listen. When it became clear the design flaw had caused at least one of its airships to crash, the Navy covered up the truth rather than risk further embarrassment. The purpose of this book is to delve into the 2 most critical years in the Navy's big rigid program, April 1933 to February 1935, and ask the question, what the heck happened? Why, after spending millions of dollars and years of effort, did the fate of the American airship come down to a brief 23-month window? Central to the answer are the heroic contributions of 4 men instrumental in building the Navy Zeppelins, each a giant who ruled the sky. Rear Admiral William A. Moffett, the first chief of the U.S. Navy's Bureau of Aeronautics, who envisioned a fleet of gargantuan military airships patrolling the Pacific to prevent a surprise attack by Japan. Paul W. Litchfield, CEO of the Goodyear Tire and Rubber Company, who not only wanted to build Zeppelins for the Navy, but also a fleet of passenger-carrying airships that spanned the globe. Goodyear Zeppelin's chief airship designer, Dr. Carl Arnstein, who, having built Zeppelins for Germany to bomb London, was determined to design the world's safest airships for his former enemy, no matter the obstacles put in his path. And the Macon's enterprising captain, Lieutenant Commander Herbert V. Wiley, upon whose shoulders the fate of the American rigid airship would ultimately fall. Each one of these four men shared the same hope for the future, a fleet of U.S.-flagged dirigibles that would extend American military and commercial hegemony from sea to sky. This dream not only ended up killing one of them, but would irrevocably change the lives of the other three while leaving a lasting mark on aviation. Sadly, the contribution of these four giants is little remembered today, despite their having once been famous. That these four men fought to overcome seemingly insurmountable odds to achieve their goal suggests just how extraordinary, if little known, the story of the American rigid airship really is. But first, a word about definitions. There are three types of airship: non-rigid, semi-rigid, and big rigid. Most people are familiar with non-rigid types. The Goodyear Blimp, which flies over sporting events, was a good example for many years. Goodyear retired its non-rigid blimp fleet in 2014, replacing it with semi-rigid airships. Blimps are designated non-rigid because their envelope contains no skeletal framework. Instead, their shape is determined by the pressure of the lifting gas inside. Non-rigids also have a gondola slung underneath, which houses the pilot and passengers, along with one or two engines mounted on their outsides. Next come semi-rigids. Semi-rigids incorporate a keel in their envelope, giving them added structural strength. As a result, semi-rigids can be built larger in size than non-rigids, allowing them to lift more and fly farther than blimps. But even then, semi-rigids don't approach the truly gargantuan size of the rigid airship. Whereas the envelope of a non-rigid or semi-rigid is shaped by the lifting gas it contains, the envelope of big rigids like the Akron, Macon, and Hindenburg are given shape by an enormous skeletal airframe. This enables the crew to live and work inside a big rigid's hull, unlike a blimp or semi-rigid where passengers and crew are confined to the gondola underneath. A big rigid's airframe is critical to its design because it supports a series of gas cells inflated with helium or hydrogen to float the airship. The reason why big rigids had to be so huge was to contain the enormous amount of LTA gas necessary to lift their sizable weight. Although a big rigid's heaviness may seem counterintuitive, it's required if the airship is to be sturdy enough to transport a large amount of people and cargo considerable distances for days at a time without landing. To give an idea of a big rigid's mind-boggling size, the Hindenburg was approximately 140 times larger than the Goodyear blimps of her day. She had to be, not only to transport 100 passengers and crew thousands of miles while serving gourmet meals in luxurious accommodations, but to transport a substantial amount of cargo, which not only included cars, but a piano for shipboard entertainment. In contrast, blimps can only carry a few people 200 or 300 miles. Only big rigids, like Germany's Hindenburg or America's Akron and Macon, were robust enough to cross an entire ocean or continent. As for the difference between a dirigible and an airship, there are none. The terms are interchangeable. The word dirigible is derived from the French verb dirigeable, meaning to steer or direct. So any LTA craft that has an engine which propels it forward and a steering mechanism like a rudder can be termed a dirigible. As for the word Zeppelin, it's a brand name used to describe airships built by Count Ferdinand von Zeppelin's company, Luftschiffbau Zeppelin. Considered the father of the big rigid, Count Zeppelin and his firm built nearly 200 airships for commercial or military use during the first 40 years of the 20th century. Since then, the word has evolved to represent an entire category, just like Kleenex, Xerox, or Hoover. For our purposes, though, Zeppelin refers only to airships conceived and built by the German Count and his eponymous company. Despite being largely overlooked, the early days of LTA flight produced a diverse number of craft, many of them awe-inspiring, both in size and design. Even today, airships permeate modern life in unexpected ways. Take, for instance, the rigid airship in Pixar's animated movie Up. It's based upon the USS Akron and her sister ship, the Macon, two Navy dirigibles that could launch and retrieve their own aircraft in mid-flight. Finally, as much as When Giants Ruled the Sky is a factual history, there is a fair amount of personal observation sprinkled throughout. For example, as a child, I never understood why the Goodyear Tire and Rubber Company had blimps. Those giant gas bags with their winged foot logos didn't seem to have anything to do with tire manufacturing. Hopefully, Giants will not only explain why a blimp fleet makes perfect sense for the company, but why it continues to operate them today. If it's hard not to be moved by the sheer size, grace, and beauty of big rigids, it's equally difficult not to be impressed by the courage and determination of the men who designed, built, and operated them. Nevertheless, airship history rarely receives the respect it deserves. The USS Akron and Macon may be sterling examples of white elephant technology, but that only makes the story of the men who struggled to build and fly them all the more inspiring. In summary, Giants intends to place rigid airships in their rightful heroic context. It's not only a reappraisal of the reason for their demise, but a celebration of the passion and daring of four larger-than-life figures whose efforts made the American Big Rigid possible. In other words, explaining why the airship went the way of the dinosaurs is at the heart of this story. And the interesting thing is, it had nothing to do with the Hindenburg. Part 1. A Giant in Flight, USS Akron, ZRS-4, 1933. 1. Admiral William A. Moffett, a giant in winter. Rear Admiral William Edgar Moffett may have been a giant who ruled the skies, but the 63-year-old chief of the Bureau of Aeronautics, BUAER, felt more like a lion in winter this dismal Monday morning. It was 2 April 1933, and the sky outside his window in Washington, D.C.'s Navy Department was claustrophobically low, its clouds a leaden shade of gray. Like it or not, the weather fitted the admiral's mood. Responsible for overseeing every aspect of naval aviation, Moffett was not only BUAER's first chief, he'd headed it for a dozen years. A champion of flight at a time when the field was still young, Moffett was considered the father of naval aviation. His crowning achievement was to persuade Congress to fund 1,000 airplanes and 2 big rigids for the Navy, the largest purchase of aircraft ever made at the time. The congressional appropriation not only put naval aviation on the map, but saved a number of American aircraft manufacturers from bankruptcy, transforming Moffett into a national figure. Even in his waning years, Moffett made a striking impression. Although he rarely smiled for the camera, favoring a stern, granite-faced expression, he was a handsome man. His high forehead, well-proportioned nose, and cleft chin lent him a patrician air that was reinforced by the pipe never far from his mouth. Not especially tall, Moffett's military bearing added inches to his height while his snow-white hair encircled his head like a laurel wreath, adding to his imperious effect. As intimidating as Moffett appeared, there was little doubt his rigid airship program was in trouble. Some people wondered why the admiral placed so much importance on the Navy's big rigids when airplanes were the coming thing. Nevertheless, Moffett was proud of his newest airship, the USS Akron. Nearly 3 football fields long and 14 stories tall, the Akron was meant to patrol the ocean to forestall a surprise attack by Japan. In the meantime, her younger sister, the USS Macon, was set to make her first test flight in just a few weeks. Moffett had heard the complaints about his big rigids. They were too expensive, accident-prone, and vulnerable to being shot down. They only flew when the sun shined, and more recently aircraft carriers had made them obsolete. The last was ironic, given Moffett was instrumental in developing carriers for the Navy. Moffat argued that airships were complementary too, not competitive with airplanes, but fewer people were buying his story. It didn't help that the Navy's first big rigid, the USS Shenandoah, ZR-1, was ripped in half by a violent thunderstorm over Ohio, killing 14 of her 43-man crew. The Navy's second big rigid, ZR-2, also suffered a horrible demise when she collapsed in midair during a trial flight over Hull, UK. 44 of her 49-man crew were killed, including 16 of the 17 Americans on board. In contrast, the USS Los Angeles, ZR-3, flew for nearly 8 years, making her the most successful big rigid the Navy had ever operated. ZR-2, which the U.S. purchased in the U.K., crashed before she had a chance to be commissioned in the U.S. Navy. As a result, she's usually referred to by her British designation, R-38. To add to the confusion, ZR-2 crashed in 1921, while ZR-1 wasn't commissioned until 1923. The Los Angeles had gone a long way towards putting concerns about Moffett's rigid airships to rest, but the Akron, the Navy's newest big rigid, had suffered a series of embarrassing mishaps calling Moffett's program into question. An astute politician, Moffett had hoped to dispel the concerns by inviting members of the House Naval Affairs Committee, which funded his airships, to take a ride on the Akron. But as the congressman waited to board, the dirigible's tail broke loose. With her bow still attached to the mooring mast, the Akron spun like a weather vane, her tail dragging across the ground with a sickening crunch. The damage was so severe the flight had to be canceled. Worse, the Akron was laid up 2 months for repairs. As one congressman witnessing the accident remarked, "When I see girders snap off like pretzels, I know something is wrong." And then there was the Camp Kearney incident. When the Akron should have been celebrating her first transcontinental voyage across the United States, three sailors holding her mooring line were inadvertently pulled into the sky over San Diego. A newsreel cameraman caught the exact moment two of the men fell to their death, making for memorable, if damning, footage. After dangling from the airship for more than an hour, the third man was pulled aboard. It was yet another black mark on the Akron's record that, along with rumors of substandard construction, continued to dog her. Powerful members of Congress felt the Akron was a white elephant, but Moffett was confident she'd live up to expectations if given a fair chance. His reasoning was sound enough. The Akron had been designed to scout thousands of square miles of ocean faster, more thoroughly, and at far less expense than the seagoing cruisers the Navy relied upon. Importantly, Moffett saw rigid airships as the best means to prevent a surprise attack by the Imperial Japanese Navy against the United States. America had been preparing for war with Japan ever since the island nation had stunned the world by defeating the Russian Navy at the Battle of Tsushima in 1905. That Japan could thrash a major Western power threatened the Big Four's hegemony, fueling racist beliefs about the coming Yellow Peril. Not one to think small, Moffett envisioned at least 10 ocean-going airships, the largest ever built, to serve as the eyes of the fleet. He already had two big rigids, the Akron, commissioned in 1931, and the USS Macon, ZRS-5, christened just that March. Whether he got the rest depended on two things: his ability to demonstrate the Akron and Macon were effective ocean-going scouts, and establishing a U.S.-based commercial airship industry to help build his aerial fleet. Until then, Moffett worried America was vulnerable to a Japanese attack. Moffett hadn't always believed in airships. "I confess to being a skeptic originally as to whether these gas bags could be of any value," he'd written. "But after I investigated the matter, I became convinced as to the ultimate desirability of their development." As far as their price tag went, he said his critics were apt to think too much about the money involved and too little about the benefits to mankind. Moffett had his work cut out for him. During the darkening days of the Depression, the Navy's battleship admirals considered naval aviation a threat since it competed with their precious surface fleet for scarce funding. This meant Moffett's airship program attracted a lot of sniping inside the Navy, which is why he felt putting over lighter than air has been the toughest job I ever undertook. Moffett may have faced increasing criticism, but he was well positioned to succeed. Two gold stripes, one thick, one thin, plus a star on his sleeve, gave him the clout he needed to get the job done. Spartan in taste and reserved in manner, he kept his emotions in check unless someone required a bawling out. But Moffat's southern charm helped contribute to his success. He was genuinely well-liked in the corridors of power, where he didn't just know who to put the arm on, but how hard to squeeze. A consummate insider, Moffat had an intuitive grasp of Washington politics. But his polite manner hid a steely determination. He'd even bypass his chain of command if it got him what he wanted. Moffat may have made it look easy, but it wasn't. Competing naval factions, inter-service rivalries, and the sclerotic nature of decision-making in Washington meant he endured many years of bureaucratic infighting. And yet he nearly always won. If Moffat had done more than anyone else to shape the future of naval aviation, he'd paid a steep price for it. Yes, he wielded tremendous power, but chief of BUAER was not a popular position in a Navy that was trying to figure out how to incorporate aeroplanes with its fighting ships. Yet Moffat had served three terms as head of the department, foregoing any chance of promotion. He'd also sacrificed his personal life. The father of six children, he'd been missing in action for most of his marriage. Remote and often gruff, he traveled so frequently he was rarely at home. His wife, Jeanette, 15 years younger, was used to his being away. Prominent in Washington society, she enjoyed the power and prestige her husband's position gave her, if not always his presence. If Moffat's reputation as a ladies' man, earned at the Naval Academy, had carried over into adulthood, he'd been discreet. As it was, his marriage was more respectful than affectionate. His children suffered as well. As Moffat's eldest daughter recalled about the admiral, he made for a great Navy officer, but not a very good father. Serving his country had certainly taken its toll. As proof, Moffat had finally begun looking his age. In fact, he'd recently lost so much weight his features had thinned to the point of sharpness. One explanation is that he suffered from congestive heart failure. If so, few, if any, people were aware of his condition. Still, photographs show him looking drawn and frail. That's not to say he'd lost his command presence. On the contrary, he remained tough as nails. But after 42 years in the Navy, he'd earned the right to be tired. Moffat was proud of his accomplishments, but he'd ruffled some feathers along the way. Roosevelt wanted to reappoint him as chief of BUAER for an unprecedented fourth term. But Secretary of the Navy Claude A. Swanson had been cool to the idea. And so, after more than four decades serving his country, Moffat was slated to retire on his 64th birthday. In the meantime, he had almost finished building Happy Landings, his 40-acre retreat overlooking the Potomac River in Virginia. One thing was certain, he'd probably have difficulty adjusting to the quiet life after wielding power for so long. Moffat's impending retirement meant he only had 6 months to get his rigid airship program on a sound footing. This wasn't a lot of time, especially since the sharks were circling. The last thing he needed that gray Monday morning was bad weather to interfere with his plans. The reason the weather so concerned Moffat was that he was scheduled to fly on the Akron later that evening. The largest, most sophisticated, most expensive aircraft built in her day, the Akron was Moffat's pride and joy. He'd even invited a VIP to join him on the flight. But the increasing gloom outside Moffat's window had him worried the flight might be canceled. Picking up the phone, the admiral placed a call to Lakehurst, New Jersey, where the Akron was based, to make sure the flight wasn't scrubbed. Normally, the chief of BUAER wouldn't bother calling a base commander about a routine training flight, but Moffat wanted to make a point. It was no secret he felt his airship captains were fair-weather flyers. "I have a feeling," he'd written, "and have had it for a long time, that the ships have not been operated as much as they should." Moffat had gone so far as to say, "It may be advisable to take one out, looking for bad weather, so we can find out what these ships can really do." Never shy about making his opinion known, Moffat had recently overseen the replacement of the Akron's commanding officer with a more aggressive airship skipper, Commander Frank C. McCord. McCord agreed that airships should fly in every kind of weather. After all, nobody wanted a big rigid that flew.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?